PCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Już wkrótce na falach BCFM, radiowski, audycja w języku polskim. Zaczynamy w niedzielę, 17 maja o godzinie 19.
Radiowski, Polish Language Broadcasting, Sunday at 7 p.m.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programs so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week we have local politician Mark Wright, who's a Clifton West councillor for the leading Liberal Democrat group. And as the French move to ban the burqa, Drive Time's Neil Roberts has been finding out what Bristol's Muslims think. Our regular political pundit and economics expert and from the Labour Party is Martin Summers. He's here too. And later on we'll be hearing what Martin thinks about last week's Conspiracy Files programme on the 7/7 London bombings, in which we both appeared. Also, Marina Morris takes a closer look at Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. But before that, here's our local two-week Friday Drive Time weather broadcast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures around about 16, 17 degrees Celsius, quite a bit of sunshine, a little bit more sunshine on Sunday than on Saturday, very light winds. Next week, it's hot, fairly hot, anyway, 18 degrees Celsius, cloud and cover and rain is more of the same, that's a little bit of cloud, but lots of sun too, and again, very little rain next week. Next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of July. Temperatures going right up to 19, 20 degrees Celsius, much less cloud and more sun, and the wind's light. Week after next, 14 degrees, colder again and rainy, and quite strong winds. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined now by Labour Party pundit Martin Summers. Martin, what are your political credentials?
Why are you asking me what my... I'm a member of the Labour Party, I'm an activist, what are you asking me?
And also, what about your background? Just to remind us about your background. You have been on the programme before.
I was working for the New Economics Foundation, and I was the East European Project Officer in the early 90s. I worked in Eastern Europe for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development. I've got a background in development economics, really.
OK, I'm also joined by Mark Wright. Mark, when were you first elected to Bristol City Council?
I was elected in 2005 first, and I'd just like to point out I'm actually the councillor for Cabot, not for...
Oh, Cabot. Are you? Sorry, yes. I actually got you down here as Cabot Ward councillor.
Yeah, right.
So what's your day job?
My day job, I used to be an astrophysicist, and then after that I had to get a real job in order to earn some money, and so I've been a software engineer since then.
Okay, what about your cabinet portfolio? Because you're one of the few councillors who's actually in the Bristol City Council's cabinet.
That's right, yes. I'm responsible for housing, service improvement and IT.
And what does that actually entail? What does that mean?
Well, the housing aspect of that is, as you would think, I'm responsible for council housing in Bristol. We've got about 28,000 council houses in Bristol, and obviously, you know, they're many of the most deprived parts of the city, and so there's lots and lots of issues, lots and lots of things to deal with. The service improvement aspect of the job is a kind of council-wide diagnostic role, whereby I'm looking for areas of the council which are not performing well. And obviously, Bristol Council is not a very well-performing council, so there's lots of things that I need to, you know, get stuck into and identify in order for other people to work on them. And the IT aspect is I've got a role just overseeing some aspects of IT, obviously because of my background in software engineering.
Now, how can you just take us through briefly? Don't take too long, but how does the cabinet system work in Bristol City Council? Maybe people won't be familiar with.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's kind of like a mini version of Parliament in that you've got the council, which is 70 members taken from areas around Bristol, all divided up into little areas called wards, and then a small number of those councillors are effectively what you would like call ministers in Westminster, which is that they have executive role, they work together, and they can actually make decisions, and they tell council officers what to do, whereas all the other councillors, all the other backbench councillors, are not really, they don't really have the power to tell other councillors, to tell council officers what to do. And that's something which surprises a lot of residents, because residents usually think that a councillor gets to decide what happens in their area, but actually they don't at all.
Now, you have something called a scrutiny board as well, don't you? Can you just explain that? Because this is the idea is that anybody in the city that's not happy with what you're doing can come along and put you under the magnifying glass.
Yeah, kind of. There are quite a few scrutiny committees, and what they are, the backbench councillors sit on these scrutiny committees, and they are, you know, they're divided up roughly along the lines that you might think, you know, one oversees culture and leisure, one oversees transport, one oversees, you know, community care. And they examine and scrutinise what the cabinet is doing and check that you know, that they're doing the right thing, and try and expose flaws or try and advise them as to good things that they should be doing instead. And yeah, the public can come along and contribute to that as well by submitting questions.
Okay, and how do people find out when these you know, sort of public sessions are available?
They're all on the council's website. If you do a web search for Bristol City Council meetings on Google, you should pretty much go straight to a website which has them all timetabled.
Very exciting page on the internet.
Yes.
Anyway, we'll be chatting to you a little bit more in a while, Mark, and to Martin. But first, Neil Roberts has a report for us, I believe, Mark. Do you, Neil?
Yep.
Hang on a second, Neil.
Sorry. In the past week, the debate on what Muslim women wear in public has once again been raging here and in France. The argument was reignited by a speech by French President Nicolas Sarkozy. He said that the burqa and the niqab, the gown and full-face veil worn mainly by Afghan and Pakistani Muslim women, are not welcome in France. He claimed that women who wear these garments are imprisoned, deprived of all social life and identity. The President's speech has been welcomed across the French political spectrum, and a cross-party group of MPs has demanded an inquiry into banning these items of clothing from being worn outside the home. Many French citizens and politicians believe that religious symbols and dress compromise France's secular republican traditions. In 2004, France banned conspicuous religious symbols from being worn in state schools, in a move which is widely seen as targeting Muslim girls who wear the hijab's headscarf. France has the highest population of Muslims in Europe. The debate in France has quickly crossed the channel, with some British newspapers, commentators and politicians calling for a ban on the burqa here. The Daily Star and Daily Express newspapers have carried front page demands for British Muslim women to be banned from wearing certain items of clothing. Incidentally, both of these newspapers are owned by Richard Desmond, who made his fortune producing pornographic magazines and TV. Liberal Democrat MEP Chris Davies has called on Muslim women in Lancashire to take off their burqa, saying that they've being forced to wear them by male relatives. David Cameron has suggested that the garments should be banned from schools because they restrict communication. Gordon Brown has said that the issue is one of freedom of choice. However, Lord Chancellor Jack Straw ignited a similar debate in 2006 when he said that Muslim women should remove their veils before speaking to him. The debate that followed that was blamed for a number of physical attacks on Muslim women wearing Islamic dress. So, how do Muslim women feel about this debate, which is being conducted mostly by non-Muslim men in the media and politics? I spoke to Anira from the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, which is based in Easton. I began by asking her how she felt about President Sarkozy's comments.
I think the first thing is that, you know, it's not the first time France has done this. You know, they've had this whole issue about banning the headscarf, which was something I couldn't understand then. And to go down the road again and try to ban the burqa or the niqab, I think it's just unacceptable. Because, you know, we should all be allowed to wear what we want. No one should be allowed to say to anyone, you can't wear this, or I find this offensive. Because at the end of the day, we're all comfortable in, you know, certain clothing and stuff. So I personally find his comments very disturbing.
Okay, and for those listeners who might be unsure what we mean when we talk about a burqa and a niqab and hijab, could you tell us a little bit about what we mean by that and why some Muslim women choose to wear these garments?
A burqa is the long black robe. And, you know, you'll see some Muslim women walk around in that. The niqab is when they've got their face covered. But both the burqa and the niqab are not an obligation. They're just clothing which some Muslim women feel cover them because of their own modesty and stuff. But the hijab is the headscarf. Now the hijab is actually an obligation for every Muslim woman. And the reason being, in the Quran it says that women are seen as precious. And because of that, they have been asked to cover up or dress in a modest way, which will protect their beauty from unwanted stares, unwanted attention. Now the reason I started wearing it, and it's only been 3 months, you know, I'm a fairly new hijabi, and I'm 27 now, and the reason I started wearing it was because I did not wear it because the scholars said it or because someone forced me to. I wore it because I was ready. At the end of the day, when a nun wants to cover up, why is it that the newspapers do not attack a nun? You know, what is the difference? And I think that confuses a lot of young Muslim women because they think, hold on, it's the same thing, but two different religions. So is this like all an attack on Islam?
And something you touched on there, a lot of people think that Muslim women wear this clothes because they're in some way forced to, either by their religion and their culture or possibly by their families and stuff. And is there any of that that goes on that you know of?
I think, yes, the older generation, you know, maybe a long time ago, due to a lot of cultural influences, may have been forced, you know, minority may have been forced. But then there's the majority who are happy to wear it. And I can only look around me now, especially in Bristol, and see how, you know, the Somalian community has come along. And the girls are absolutely beautiful, and they have bought the most brightest colours, they've bought fashions, you know, they've made the hijab a part of their everyday clothing. And it's obvious to say that women are actually walking around with different colours on, with different styles, because they're proud of what they're doing, because they're proud of the hijab.
When I was looking through some of the recent press coverage of this issue, there seems to be lots of different reasons that the opponents of this of the full face veil come up with when they're talking about why it should be banned or whatever. So you've got Sarkozy talking about the oppression of women, and then David Cameron was saying that it's about communication difficulties. Then other people just say they're intimidated or scared. Do you think there's any valid criticisms in any of this at all?
I think in terms of oppression, I think, you know, we really need to let go of that one now. I think, you know, around us, like I said, there's so many young Muslim women who have chosen to wear the headscarf. So I think that one I just kind of, you know, tut away at. I think in terms of intimidation, I can understand that because, you know, sometimes it is difficult to kind of talk to someone who's completely covered from head to toe. You can't see their face or anything. And again, you know, communication is an issue. But then, is it not fair to say that someone who has tattoos on their face, a lot of piercings, is, you know, is very intimidated? You know, how far are we going to go to fight this argument? At the end of the day, I personally don't wear the burqa, but I will not criticise someone who does.
What do you think needs to be done to kind of get over this hostility that exists amongst the minority of British people and in the media and stuff? Do you think it's about, as some people say, it's about Muslims integrating more and trying to fit in more and being more British, whatever that might mean? Or do you think it's about confronting Islamophobia and racism and stuff, or is there a balance between that?
I think it's definitely confronting, and I think, you know what, we have to definitely take the first step, and I think to kind of eradicate such misconceptions, you know, there has to be open dialogue, there has to be people willing to speak. Don't feel afraid to ask a Muslim questions that you don't understand. And I think this whole kind of we don't want to talk or let's just generalise is only going to destroy Britain. And like you said, what is being British? You know, all my life I've thought to myself, I'm British, but what is British? British is a bit of everything. We have all integrated. It's not one community is integrating more than the other. It's we are all British people, and that's what should matter. Why should it make a difference that I have this belief or you have that belief? Why is it that we can't come together as British people, as humans?
So, Neil, what's provoked this debate in France, and what are the issues behind President Sarkozy's comments about the burqa?
Well, like I said, Sarkozy was talking about the French tradition of secularism, where the separation of church and state, so that's a big issue in France. But also there's a big issue with racism, particularly against Muslim, North African, and more recent immigrants. And that was seen, like, Sarkozy built his reputation before he became president, built his reputation as the interior minister when he tackled the riots in most of the immigrant communities where there's riots that are generally provoked by poverty and discrimination and stuff. So he built his reputation on being hardline against that. And I think at the moment Sarkozy is really unpopular because of his economic policies, unemployment and attempts to attack workers' rights and stuff. And I think some people would see this as a way of distracting from his own unpopularity and a kind of divide and rule tactic.
So what do French, ordinary French people think about the issue? Never mind the president.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of support in France for the secular values, and what you see in France is there's actually a cross-party support for especially the ban on the hijab a few years ago, where you also saw the political left, which in this country you'd see as defending multiculturalism and being opposed to this kind of ban, actually a lot of support for this kind of these kind of laws. And actually one of the leading campaigners for this ban is actually a Communist Party MP, so it's a different perspective than you'd get in this country.
Okay, let's go have a look at Britain then. What sort of support is there here for banning certain types of Muslim dress?
Well, there was an opinion poll in 2006, was the most recent one I could find, and it said 77% of British people were opposed to a ban on the hijab headscarf. So I don't think there's a massive popular support, and like I said, there's a couple of politicians that make noises about being opposed to what they see as the oppression of Muslim women through dress, but I don't think there's much mainstream political support for banning any particular items of clothing. Obviously the BNP, the fascist BNP, obviously anti-Muslim, they've been making an issue of this, also sections of the media, the right-wing press like the Daily Mail, the Express, the Star and the Sun have all run stories which to some degree support what Sarkozy is saying. The Express ran a story actually linking the issue with the 7/7 terror attacks. The Daily Star ran a front page headline that said burqa off, and said that 96% of its readers support a ban, and was also trying to link the issue with terrorism. But
so why do you think this is an issue that keeps popping up again and again in the press?
Well, when I spoke to Anira from the Muslim Cultural Society, she spoke about the increased hostility to Muslims since 9/11, and obviously the war in Afghanistan and Iraq has led to a kind of ongoing attacks on Muslims in the street and in the media and stuff. It's a kind of scapegoating thing that comes along with wars, I think, and obviously the burqa was made a big issue in the run-up to the war in Afghanistan. It was seen as a way of issue where Britain and America needed to liberate Afghan women, and obviously we've got an economic crisis going on, and whenever there's an economic crisis there's an increase in this kind of racist scapegoating, and people looking, especially people on the right and those in power, looking for people to blame other than the people causing the real problems.
Well, thanks ever so much for that report, Neil. Now, let's just go back to Councillor Mark Wright. Mark, what do you think about this issue? I mean, how do you think it affects people here in Bristol?
I think I would largely agree with a lot of the analysis that we just heard, actually. I mean, personally, I wouldn't support a ban on any of the headscarf or burqa or niqab at all. I'm a libertarian, and I think that people should basically be allowed to wear what they want, even if what they want to wear seems a bit strange and weird to us. I mean, the argument that this is about oppression, I think, is very worrying. The moment you start banning one set of clothing because you say it's oppression, you know full well the next set that they'll be after will be, bikinis and miniskirts, because there are people out there who say that those are oppressive clothes. They say that's about male oppression of women. You know, and I say, if people want to wear that, that's fine. I mean, I find it strange that someone would want to cover themselves head to foot. And there is, I would say there is a common sense angle. I mean, I know that there was a case some time ago where a Muslim teacher wanted to wear full face covering, and there you've got to use a bit of common sense. You know, it's true to say that a good deal of human communication is through the face, and if a teacher is trying to cover their face, I think that's just daft. You know, it's got nothing to do with religion, it's just a bit silly, and I think, you know, in that situation you can say, look, come on, you've got to, you know, have your face exposed. It might be that there are some kids who are hard of hearing who actually take more from your face than they do from, you know, what you're saying. But it's just, I agree with the analysis that a lot of this is just scapegoating at the moment.
What about you, Martin? What do you think about
it? Well, obviously, I agree with what everybody else has said. I haven't got really much to add, although I think it's quite sinister, this kind of thing. We all know about the war on terror, and later on in the programme we're going to be talking about the Conspiracy Files programme that we were both on, questioning the government's story about the London bombings. Now, if what we're suggesting is correct about this, then what may be happening here is similar to a kind of strategy of tension that we saw in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, where
a certain community is being scapegoated in order to try and you know, allow invasions of foreign countries in order to allow another agenda to be undertaken, and this whole business of making the Muslims the problem is the problem.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the other stories this week. One of the things I picked out yesterday was that the Israeli government and the Israeli military are worried because there's what they call a legal war against them, which is to do with possible being sued for war crimes over the January's war in Gaza. What are your thoughts about that, Martin? Stay with you for this to begin with.
Well, I mean, they're worried about a legal war because most of what their war fighting involves is illegal. And I think if we expect people like British Muslims to obey the rule of law, as we do, then that's got to cut both ways. And if the Israeli state is not prepared to play by the rules of the rest of the international community, they've got to be isolated. And I understand Mark's party have taken a very strong line on this, and I thoroughly approve of it.
But, I mean, surely the Israeli state has the right to defend itself.
That's not the same thing. Everybody's got the right to defend themselves. They weren't defending themselves when they charged into Lebanon in 2006. They weren't defending themselves when they were devastating Gaza earlier this year. They've lost the moral high ground, and they've got to draw back.
Mark, what's your thoughts on this?
Unsurprisingly, I'm in pretty much complete agreement with that. Israel is an occupying power. It's one of the few places in the world where a sovereign country is occupying somewhere else. And I know that the Israeli government always gets very upset about the way it seems to be singled out and constantly harassed, but, you know, there aren't other countries around the world that have been occupying other people for decades. And that's why the legal harassment, as they consider it, continues. And it's quite fair to point out, well, you know, what would you rather? Would you rather be legally harassed, or would you rather be bombed, you know?
The Serbs were bombed, yeah. if you remember. During the war in Yugoslavia, what we said to them is, you get out of Kosovo, we're going to blow up your TV stations and devastate your infrastructure. But the Israelis, they don't even get a slap on the wrist.
Okay, next story we're having a look at. The government has unveiled a £1.5 billion housing boost, which includes, for the first time for many years, enough money for 3,000 extra council homes. Now, is this good news for you, Mark? Because you're actually a housing representative on the city council here.
Yes, it is good news. I'm very pleased to see it. I mean, we're not sure of all the details yet, and we're still making sure that the money isn't sort of old money that's being re-announced. We've got to check that it is new money. But if it is new money coming into the system, then we're delighted to see that. I'm very keen to see new council houses built in Bristol and new houses built by registered social landlords. It's good news for a number of reasons. I mean, we've got a terrible, terrible housing shortage in Bristol and many other cities. But not only that, of course, the economy is in a tailspin at the moment, in particular construction. And what was really useful to keep the economy buoyant is to start building stuff, get the construction trade going, get men and women into jobs, putting bricks together, building stuff, and then getting families who are homeless into those houses.
But is it a National Liberal Party policy to be spending money on council housing? Because this is really, I think, we have to look back to the 1970s and early 80s since the last council houses were built.
That's right, yeah. No, actually, you'd be surprised. It has been Lib Dem policy for quite some years now to invest more in council housing. And I know the Labour Party has had, Labour Party conferences, they've consistently had motions passed by the floor that council housing should be restarted, and that the fourth option, as they call it, for councils that want to keep their council housing stock should be allowed to invest in their stock. Unfortunately, the leadership hasn't followed through with what their members are saying, and I'm sure that Martin will respond to that. But
the other silly thing, of course, is that over the last few years there's been talk of the council selling off its current stock here in Bristol. Was it a referendum or something? I think there was.
There was a kind of referendum. Well, it wasn't really a referendum. No, there was a kind of consultation done some years ago. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. The council house residents were very clear. They said, no, we want to stay with the council, and we're absolutely behind that. That's settled, and there's no dispute about that.
Well, obviously, I agree with this. I mean, it's a bit late in the day. Because what should have happened, of course, if we'd kept up a consistent social housing policy through the 80s, the 90s and so on,
maybe we wouldn't have had a property bubble, because people would have had an option to have some other place to live. And I speak personally, now I'm in private rented accommodation, and I'm about to be made homeless because the people who owned my house have gone bankrupt. And it's now owned by the Bank of Ireland, which is owned by the Irish government, which is owned by whoever is buying the Irish government's bonds. I mean, the whole housing policy is in a complete mess. It's good that they've finally turned the corner to doing something sensible, but goodness me, it's taken long enough, hasn't it?
Right, well, we're staying with the bigger stories. We've just just pulled this out of today's Daily Mail. This story is about Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is now paying California's bills with state IOUs. Apparently, yesterday, he issued 28,000 IOUs, worth a total of £32 million in British money. What does this say about the state of the finances in California, and are we close to that in Bristol, Mark?
Well, we're not close to IOUs. the way they do finance in government in America is very different. I mean, the state government has got its own finances, which are completely independent of, you know, the other levels of government, because they're a federal country. Here in Britain, we're not. You know, the council is not allowed to run deficits, and it gets basically, you know, 90% of its it gets half of its money from the government, which we basically have to beg for. The other half comes from council tax. But there's no, you know, across the world, all governments and all companies pretty much are in real financial trouble. And this is, you know, make no mistake, this is a massive recession that we're in, a really massive
one. Can you guarantee to us that the money that you've got at Bristol City Council is invested in safe places, so that it's not like Icelandic banks that may collapse at any minute?
Well, that was before our time running council. Obviously, as a result of what happened in Iceland, the council's investments were reassessed, and they've pulled some back from what looked like it was a little bit risky, and we've now got a policy of investing in only much safer banks, which, because most of those banks have now nationalised, basically means we're only really investing money in banks which are securitised and backed by our own government.
What about you, Martin? What do you think about this situation of IOUs being used?
Well, I think this is the problem with where we've got to with the crisis as a whole. Obama, when he came to power, had an opportunity to change the direction of the policy. And I'm sad to say, and it gives me no pleasure to say it, that he hasn't done so. His economics team, Geithner, Summers and Rubin, are Wall Street insiders. And so instead of nationalising the banks and restructuring the economy, they've decided to just carry on printing money to keep the banks afloat. But of course, the problem with printing money is that other people have to want to buy your bonds, as it were. Yeah? Now, the Chinese central bank is sitting on all of these IOUs already, effectively. I mean, and the problem is that at a certain point, either by accident or design, you understand, if the Chinese central bank decided to pull the plug for political reasons, they could, but it may just happen because the markets are spooked, there'll be a run on the dollar, and then what we may be moving into is a hyperinflationary depression, which we haven't seen before. Not like the 30s. In the 30s, there was mass unemployment and crashing prices, but you'll have mass unemployment plus inflation, which means that people on benefits, if they're living on benefits, that the worth of those benefits will disintegrate. This is Russia 1991.
Well, it's a bit of a nightmare scenario, but that's for the dollar. I mean, how is that likely to affect us here in Britain?
Well, we're linked into all of this. I mean, America sneezes, the world catches cold. I mean, then the American trade negotiators worked very hard to globalise their problems. Yeah, that's what it was all about. So that they're able to, they've made sure that everybody's tied into them. So if they collapse, then everybody goes with them. It's insane, and what they've actually done is thrown away the conventional economics textbook I was taught at Oxford University in the 70s. They've thrown it away, thrown it in the waste paper basket, and said, we don't care about that.
Well, it's very easy for you to snipe at the sidelines, from the sidelines there, but what would you do?
I would nationalise the banks, as the Liberals have suggested in this country, and then we've got to move away from having a finance-driven economic policy. And it's perfectly rational. I mean, the Japanese, for years and years and years, ran their country with very controlled banks, and very little speculation. Most deals were settled in cash, and that's because they were concentrating on making stuff, and the money is mainly a means to the end. What we've done is we've become, we're just tricksters and shysters. We think we can make money out of nothing, and of course you can't. You've got to actually produce something.
Okay, let's focus down on some more local stories now. Shirehampton residents, we're told in the Evening Post earlier this week, are going to fight the council's attempts to sell off open space. Mark, what are you doing selling off open spaces in Shirehampton?
Well, I'm familiar with the area. I'm not familiar with the exact space itself. So, I mean, I can't say for sure where this has come from.
Well, it's called the Lamplighters Open Space, and it represents apparently the only public park on the banks of the Tidal Avon within all of Bristol City's boundaries. I mean, open spaces surely are the lungs of the city, and it's part of the council's job to be preserving them.
Yes, it is. I mean, there is a difference between an open space and a park, and I'm not sure whether that area is a park or an open space. I mean, the reality is that, you know, there is a massive need for house building, and we nearly everybody agrees that building on the Greenbelt is a bad idea, and therefore we need to build inside the urban limit. Now, this area is inside the urban limit. If it's a park, then I would say, yeah, I mean, I would obviously want to know why are we building on this park? If it's an open space, then I think, you know, they have to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Is it an open space where some people walk their dogs, you know, and kids occasionally play football? Or is it an open space where much of the local community goes and has picnics and plays? You know, the result of that makes a big difference, you know, as to whether or not it's fair that some of it should be used to build on. I'm pretty sure that the plan is not to build on all of it. I'm pretty sure that the suggestion is that they might use some of it.
Okay, Martin, what do you think about building on open spaces?
Well, in general, obviously, I would be opposed to it, but people have got to live somewhere, and you know, you've got to make... If we're going to build all these new council houses, they'll have to go somewhere.
Well, hang on, I'm getting a bit frustrated with both of you here, because, I mean, what I see as part of this recession is quite a lot of industrial space, which is just lying derelict.
Well, exactly.
I mean, surely it would make sense.
Well, exactly. Maybe knock down redundant factories and build the council houses.
To use the planning system to say to developers, well, if you want to develop, I mean, we know you've got no money, developers, hardly any, because of the recession, but if you're going to develop, you know, use these old sites.
Yeah, sure. I mean, clearly, old derelict sites, which are not going to be reused, are absolutely the ones that will be used. To be fair, nearly all of those have gone. They nearly all went in the property bubble, you know, when they were snapped up and developers made millions on the back of them. But the flip side of that coin is, okay, so lots of people are out of work now and lots of companies are going bust. If you build on all of their factory sites and all of their business sites, where do the jobs come from when the recovery starts? There's nowhere for people to go to start up new jobs. And the problem with that is that we'll end up with not enough job capacity in the city in order for people to go back to work. We'll have lots of people in houses but unemployed, and that's not a great solution either.
Right, finally, our story is another one, a bit of a grim one to do with the City Council, which is that apparently the Council has to cut £30 million in just 3 years. This was in yesterday's Bristol Evening Post, that they're facing £30 million worth of cuts and job losses during the next 3 years. That's quite a sizeable chunk of the 16,000 staff the council employs. Mark, you've just come into a new administration after the election last month, and this is the first bit of news. We're going to have massive cuts.
Yeah, I know. Clearly, this is not what we wanted to find when we came in, when we came in and took over the council.
Well, to be fair, you were running the council before the elections as well. The Liberal group was.
Well, for two months, yeah. We were in charge for 2 months after the Labour Party resigned at the end of February. Obviously, it's not what we wanted to see. But, you know, I think we've got to be honest with the people about what the state of the finances is. I mean, we've got two problems. Number one is the recession. And that means that there's much more demand on services because there are more people on benefits, there are more people who are feeling the strain, you know, there are more people who are vulnerable. And that places a strain on all the services, so the cost of providing those services go up. Number two, the recession also means the cost of land has gone down and the money that the council makes from its business has also gone down. But number three, you know, we have to be perfectly honest that whoever wins the next general election, and I think most people are pretty sure that it's going to be the Conservative Party, although, I mean, obviously I would like it to be the Lib Dems, and obviously Martin wants it to be the Labour Party, but whoever wins it has got to get the nation's finances under control. You know, at the moment we're spending miles beyond our means, and what that means is from next year everybody knows that the amount of money the government gives to all of its agencies, including local government, is going to go way down. It's going to go way down. And we have to prepare for that, because if we just sort of put our fingers in our ears and march into next year thinking nothing's going to happen, it's all going to be hunky-dory, then when the government cut comes, which it will, then we'll be completely messed up.
I've got your focus on fixing Bristol, which is the Lib Dems poster you had up just before the last local elections. One of the things that I notice here is we're being promised 3 new libraries, a new school and a new swimming pool. Is that all still going to go ahead?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, it's going to be tough, obviously, because the money going round is a lot less than it was when we started formulating our plans. But we will find ways to deliver those, and we're reasonably sure that we can.
Well, it doesn't sound all that confident to me.
No, I'm confident we can find them. I'm absolutely confident.
And we've also got here another one of the things you're saying is that you're going to keep council tax as low as possible, which I suppose is a just about vague enough, isn't it? And fight for it to be scrapped.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We have for many, many years wanted to scrap the council tax. We think it's unfair. It's quite a regressive tax, which means it hits the poor harder. You know, a millionaire's mansion pays only perhaps 3 times as much council tax as someone living in a council flat. That's completely unfair. We should replace it with a fair local tax, which is based on ability to pay. The simplest way to do that is a local income tax.
You've got to get your boys into Westminster before
you
can manage that one.
We have.
So, Martin, what do you think about these cuts? I mean, is it inevitable? Is there some real inevitability? Or is it just being used as a way to punish the poor? I think
at the level of Bristol City Council, Mark is quite right. I mean, you can't at that level buck what's happening in the overall environment. But I don't necessarily agree with what he's saying about cutting expenditure in whoever wins the next election. I think that you've got to raise taxes on the wealthy. You've got to balance the books. You can. It's fascinating, isn't it? We were told for years and years and years we've got to balance the books. And Keynes was dead, and then suddenly a recession hits, and it's always so we didn't have to balance the books. Rubbish. Now, of course, at a certain point, you do have to balance, and you're supposed to balance over the cycle. That's the Keynesian way of managing it. But at the same time, I can't see that cutting government expenditure going into this horrendous economic storm makes any sense at all. You want to keep people in work if you can, and you want to keep them producing, and you certainly want to protect them from impoverishment. But that means somebody has got to pay. Now, in my book, the people who've got to pay are the wealthiest people in the country who have done very, very well out of the Thatcher bubble, which has now burst. If you look at what their personal wealth is now compared to what it was when Thatcher came to power in 1980, most of those people have done fantastically well. They are rich beyond the dreams of avarice from where they were in 1980 in a controlled system. Now, somebody's got to pay for the crisis. Those are the people. It's get your chequebooks out time, folks.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think the Lib Dems have come forward with a couple of other ideas. I mean, we would scrap ID cards and we would scrap the renewal of Trident, and straight away that gives you billions and billions that you could use to pump into the economy.
We could stop invading foreign countries.
Yeah, that would also help. I mean, you said that Liberals need to win places in Parliament in order to try and get these things through. I'm actually a parliamentary candidate in Bristol South as well, so I'm hoping to be one of those people who will be able to make these decisions. But I mean, it's also true that the gap between rich and poor has grown in this country amazingly over the last decade. There is scope to get a bit more from the wealthy. Vince Cable has outlined ways to do that by closing obscure loopholes that most people have never heard of, called higher rate pension relief and some other things. But even with that, going back to something that Martin mentioned before about the confidence that external entities have in taking our bonds, we have to keep confidence in British bonds and in the British currency. And the reality is, if the budget gap isn't closed, it would be possible to have a run on the pound here as well. Mm-hmm. Already people are making noises about the fact that our public borrowing is 13% of our GDP. And that needs to be got in control next year, or else there could be real trouble.
Okay, so we're going to wind up in a minute, but finally, can you just give us, this is a bit of a controversial one, what do you think about local press here? We've got basically the BBC up at White Ladies Row, we've got ITV and the Bristol Evening Post, and one or two other much smaller ones. Do you think that they're good enough at covering what the council does?
They don't cover it enough. I don't think they do. The BBC and ITV local, they're very good. They're very good and well researched, but I don't think they cover enough of what the council's doing. The Evening Post, increasingly, I think, doesn't cover it as well. And part of that is to do with the fact that its Bristol operations are closing down, really. I mean, they've shed loads of staff, and they're moving, you know, they're shifting things away in order to make savings because they're losing out to the internet and other news outlets, and their circulation is dropping. And I'm really worried that we might lose the Evening Post. I mean, as a politician and now the administration, they've not been our best friends. They do like to put the boot into politicians generally, and they're not always particularly accurate. But nevertheless, you know, they're the least bad in the sense that they're probably the only printed media that still pays any attention at all, and I'm worried that we'll lose them.
So is this one of the reasons that you're spending so much at the council on this, Our City magazine, which I get through the door about, I think it's once a month or something now? It must cost a fortune to distribute that right around the city. But the thing is, it's not a journalistic thing, is it? It's really just from the council's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, the council has to get out its message to the people of what it's doing, what kind of things they can apply for. You know, if they're changing some kind of benefit or if they're creating some kind of new service, the people have got to know. And if the local media, you know, if the BBC, the ITV and Evening Post don't take it up, then the council's just simply throwing its money down the drain unless people know about it. It's got to have a method to get it out there, and that Our City, as it's called, is the method. And it doesn't cost as much money as you might think, actually, because I think there is advertising revenue from it. Clearly it would be false economy to spend loads of money advertising services, you know.
Yeah, maybe you could just buy a page in the Evening Post once a month or something. It might be a bit cheaper. Anyway, thanks very much, Mark, for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much.
And Martin, we're going to go on to a little session with you now, talking about the 7/7 London bombings. And Martin and I were on a programme on the BBC Two on Tuesday earlier on this week, where the 7/7 London bombings were discussed. And we appeared in this hour-long Conspiracy Files programme. Now, Martin, can I just start by asking you, what did you think of the way that you were presented by the BBC?
Well, I was hardly covered. I mean, you were being the spokesperson by and large. There was only a couple of bits from me. And I, you know, the way I was presented, I thought was okay, but it's not me, the presentation of my personal... my personality that's at stake here. It's the issues.
Okay. What do you think overall was the impression you got sitting watching it? I mean, do you think that it was a helpful documentary? I mean, for people that didn't see it was really just examining some of the what you might call conspiracy theories or else anomalies in the official government account of events on the 7th of July 2005.
Well, I mean, it was basically a hit job. I think Tristram Quinn, who made the film, and he came here, as you know, to film us the other week. I think he'd made his mind up that this was basically going to be a hit job. These people are crazy, whatever. But within that, of course, the reason why we cooperated, as you well know, is to get the issue on the agenda, which I believe we have done. And we're hoping to be on radio. I'm hoping to be on Radio 4 on Sunday to explore some of the issues. And we're also having a meeting in Birmingham Central Mosque on Sunday night, which we're both going to be attending.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But there have been some big developments in the last few weeks. Firstly, this chap Jamil Rahman is suing the ex-Home Secretary Jackie Smith, saying that she had knowledge of threats that MI5 are alleged to have made against him whilst he was in detention in Bangladesh. Jamil says that he was threatened by MI5 that he would be raped and his wife would be raped if he did not confess that he was the mastermind of the 7/7 London bombings. What do you think of that, Martin?
Well, it's very interesting that they're trying to, what looks like, fit somebody up for to be the mastermind of the London bombings through torture, because the person that was named originally as the mastermind of the London bombings, Haroon Aswat, is actually in preventive detention in Britain under this kind of catch-all non-habeas corpus system. And not only that, he's actually been confined to Broadmoor on the grounds that he's crazy.
What do you mean by this catch-all non-habeas corpus?
Well, I mean, there are a number of people in Britain who are being held without any legal basis, yeah? They've not been convicted of any crime, they're just being held in a preventive way. Pretty similar, I suppose, to what used to go on in Northern Ireland with the internment without trial. But, of course, what internment without trial allows the government to do is take away uncomfortable and difficult people and remove them from the equation, the reason being that Aswat was named by American sources as an MI6 double agent. So it looks as if the real mastermind may very well have been working for British intelligence all along. And I think that raises an awful lot of questions. And if people think that British intelligence doesn't do stuff like that, I refer them to the Barron Report, which is signed off by Justice Henry Barron of the Irish Supreme Court, and was based on a decades-long investigation by the Garda Síochána of the Irish police, which definitely pointed the finger at the British intelligence services for the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, in which 28 people died. Now, in other words, it's not unthinkable to imagine that something like that could have happened on 7-7, because it certainly happened in Dublin and Monaghan.
Also, a new book is out called The Terrorist Hunter by ex-Scotland Yard anti-terror chief Andy Hayman. He's been saying things like, the biggest lesson, to quote him, the biggest lesson that came out of 7-7 was that that overall our internal communications were an utter shambles. Hayman says he wrote the book after retiring last year, after 30 years in the Metropolitan Police, because he wanted to write a true inside account of the aftermath of the Genoa bombings. The drama, the complexity, the turmoil, and the mistakes. A vivid contemporary history that historians would refer to and from which lessons could be learned. Anyway, his book was banned this Wednesday by Baroness Scotland, the Attorney General, so it seems we may have another spycatcher-like case on our hands. This time the book, as I said, is called The Terrorist Hunters, and here is Andy Hayman speaking last weekend. He explains what he thinks of the so-called War on Terror.
It's very difficult to get the right phraseology. If you think about a war, the images in your mind are explosions, loss of life, trauma, upset. That's exactly what the effects of terrorism gives the families and the bereaved families and survivors. And yet that is a very aggressive, emotive term. And to try and put that into our communities when we're in peacetime, I think rubs against the grain. And so I think privately it does describe what goes on in terrorism, but I think publicly a less emotive, softer, mellower phrase is more appropriate. After the terrible atrocities of July 05, we were getting lots of reports through intelligence of further attacks. That's inevitable because we're asking the public to tell us if they suspected anything or anything, any suspicious activity. And I remember on one particular occasion, which is actually commentated in the book, where we deployed across the streets of London for public safety an enormous amount of armed police, visibly armed. And what we were trying to do there is create a hostile environment for the terrorists to operate, to deter them, but at the same time create a safe, reassuring atmosphere for the public. I just met the families and the families of the bereaved and the survivors. And one man stood up and he said, "Mr. Hayman, I know you can't answer this question, but why is it that the first bus that my son got on after the bombings on the underground, he lost his life?" And then right across that room, like a Mexican wave, people stood up and gave personal testaments. And I don't care how hard you are, to be confronted with that on your watch brought a man to tears.
That was ex-anti-terror chief at Scotland Yard Andy Hayman there, and his book The Terrorist Hunters was banned by the Attorney General on Wednesday this week, even though apparently some of the copies of it are still around. What do you think about what he had to say, Martin?
Well, I mean, in general, of course, he's right. The use of the word war on terror is completely unhelpful. But of course, what we suspect is that what we've got here is what in Italy was called the strategia di tensione, the strategy of tension, so that what happens is that events like bombings take place, the state accrues more power to itself, and the various political goals can be achieved. In Italy, it was to keep the Communist Party from being elected into the government. Now, Andy Hayman, I suspect, is an honourable police officer, a bit like Brian Paddock, and I think Brian Paddock came over quite well in the film on Tuesday. He was very measured, as you would expect, and of course he was taken off the investigation, and I think that says a lot about the politics surrounding this business.
Well, the BBC only spoke to two eyewitnesses of the tube bombings as part of their Conspiracy Files programme. One was the so-called spokesperson for the victims, Rachel North, and the other was dancer from Cambridge, Bruce Late, who said he thought the bomb might have actually been underneath the underground train he was on. Anyway, I thought it was a poor show to have only two witnesses, since there were obviously many thousands of people involved. So I found another one. Paul Harrison used to work as a Ministry of Defence policeman and is now still working for the Ministry of Defence. I spoke to him last month about his experiences and what he remembers seeing in London that day.
Well, my name's Paul Harrison. At the time, I was actually working on the NHS project, modernising their systems. And at the time, we were actually putting some systems into the UCLH hospital, which is just around the corner from Warren Street.
So what did you see that morning, roughly? You know, can you just take us through it?
Basically, the building we were in, it's all got glass fronts, and it's basically just...
It's fine.
You're able to see out all the time. It's not like a case of a window. The whole walls were basically glass, basically. Up to a certain extent, anyway. And I remember, very briefly, the morning of the bombings, actually looking out the window and seeing police. And this is prior to the bombings actually going off. And they're all on the bridge, going over the main circular roads going around London, or where Warren Street is. And it looked to me as if they were actually doing some sort of exercise anyway.
What were they actually doing, these police, and how can you tell when police are involved in an exercise or if they're just doing a normal patrol?
I couldn't ascertain that. It's obviously just my assumption they were doing an exercise, but some of them were actually dressed up in sort of chemical, biological protection.
Well, it's obviously not a normal police patrol.
Well, that's one of... I didn't actually think about it at the time, because it was just a quick glimpse out the window, noticed it, and then walked away. And it wasn't until afterwards that the whole bombing stuff went on, and all the police sirens and all the rest of the stuff. But it wasn't until later on, when I was sort of sifting through the alternative information about 7-7, that I came across the fact that was reported they were doing... these chemical, biological exercises.
So you also talked about like manhole covers and things like that. So how was that involved?
Well, obviously the guys with the protection suits on. They had the old detection kit equipment, and they were obviously going around the manhole covers and the drainage grills. You know, just poking them down. They're obviously sniffing for chemicals or whatever. I don't know.
Well, that's the sort of thing you'd expect in some sort of exercise or drill, or if there was some kind of pre-warning that something was going on. Tell me, how did you, did you draw any conclusions from this, or does it just make you suspicious, and how has this left you now feeling about the whole 7-7 business?
At the time, it didn't really register with me. As I say, it was just a glimpse out the window, registered it, and then it wasn't until later on when I started... hearing some of the rumours about 7-7, I started investigating it myself, and then I became very suspicious.
So what's your feeling now? Do you think that there's anything more that can be done about 7-7, or do you think we should just forget about it and move on?
To be quite honest with you, I couldn't say who did it, but I think there's a lot of questions. A lot of questions to be answered.
That was ex-Ministry of Defence policeman Paul Harrison there with what he saw on the morning of July 7th, 2005, before the bombs went off. So, Martin, we're having a meeting at Birmingham Central Mosque. Can you just tell us about that this weekend on Sunday?
Yes, it's taking place at 6 p.m. in Birmingham Central
Mosque. Hang on a second.
Hello, it's taking place at 6 p.m. in Birmingham Central Mosque. Obviously, not many Bristol listeners will know where that is. And it's being sponsored by a group called All Faiths Against Terrorism. Nobody here is supporting terrorism. What we will be doing is discussing the various theories which have developed about what might have happened on that day, and other things as well, the context.
Well, Martin, thanks very much for all that. Now, Marina, this week you are looking at longevity in Russia and the lifestyle of the Russian Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin.
Oh, yes. Longevity in Russia is substantially different from Western Europe and most other industrialized countries. Life expectancy is about 15 years lower than most other European countries. Russia's men have a life expectancy of less than 60. For example, the typical British male lifespan is 75. Experts point out that much of Russia's health crisis is the result of an unhealthy lifestyle. In particular, there are very high rates of alcohol abuse and smoking. And the healthy lifestyle of Russian Prime Minister Mr. Putin has been an important role model for Russian people.
Okay, so is introducing standards of a healthy way of life leading by example. So young Russian boys picking up on what Mr. Putin's doing.
Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin last year released an instructional Judah DVD to celebrate his 56th birthday. Remember, this is an age close to an average Russian month's life expectancy of less than 60. Putin believes that without sport, it's impossible to speak of a healthy way of life, about the health of nation as such. He's a black belt and former judo champion in his home city, St. Petersburg. He does not smoke, he does not drink alcohol, or at least drink so rarely that it appears that way. Putin spends long hours at work in Kremlin. He gets up early and finishes work later between 10 o'clock and midnight. His daily lifestyle includes 1.5 hours physical exercise, usually including a 20-minute swim. During his rare free time, Putin listens to popular classical music, particularly Tchaikovsky and Schubert. He loves Russian classical literature work, French films, and Austrian-born star Romy Schneider in his favorite Western actor.
So has Mr. Putin's physical fitness actually added to his popularity?
Yes, I believe it has. The release of this DVD massively increased the popularity of judo in Russia, and the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, was keen to take judo lessons, saying, we have decided to do some training together. When asked the question, how much confidence do you have in Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin to do the right things for world affairs internationally, Mr. Putin scored next to last. However, 82% of Russian respondents have confidence in him.
Okay, but does that imply that he's only really trusted and admired in his own country, or there are people elsewhere?
He is not only trusted in Russia. Despite difficult relations between Russia and Ukraine, 57% of Ukrainians support him. Mr. Putin is popular and also has a confidence majority of Indians and Chinese. Levels of trust are very much lower in Western Europe, with a low of 10% in France.
So maybe it would be a good idea if Gordon Brown did a bit more sports. Okay, thanks very much, Marina. Well, it's coming up to 6 o'clock, so that's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we'll be reviewing the week and picking apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. Next week, we'll be looking at food and farming. Nowadays, animals from all over the world end up on our dinner plates, but should we be concerned about what conditions they're raised in? If you have news you want discussed, questions about tonight's programme, or would like to suggest a topic, then please do email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our reporter Neil Roberts. Our guests were Lib Dem Councillor Mark Wright from Cabot Ward and resident pundit was Martin Summers. Vladimir Putin was scrutinised by Marina Morris. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you another relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and about 60 million acres of land, so it might seem sometimes there's not enough resources to go around. That's only because corporations and the super rich have taken quite literally piles more than their fair share. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And again, thanks to Glenn at CascadiaPublicRadio.org, who not only serves up Media Monarchy and the Corbett Report and Ground Zero Lounge and Alan Watt, Wayne Madsen, Webster Tarpley, on and on and on and on. Actually, if you just subscribe to Glenn's feed on RadioForAll.net, that'll pretty much cover you for all your alternative radio news needs.